This is a HeadGum Podcast.
While Andrew and Craig believe the joy of discovery is crucial to enjoying any well-told tale, they will not shy away from spoiling specific story beats when necessary. Plus, these are books you should have read by now.
Hey everybody, welcome to Overdue. It's a podcast about the books you've been meaning to read. My name is Craig.
My name's Andrew.
And this is one of our bonus episodes.
We're back again.
Yep.
More extra content.
This is our December bonus episode that we are doing on Milan Kundera's The Unbearable Lightness of Being, which is recommended to us by some Patreon supporters, Emily and Mandy. Thank you both. And we have Patreon supporters in the chat with us as we record this episode. So, hey, chat, how's it going? I'm waving.
I'm always curious to see, because we've done a lot of different kinds of books with the chat watching, and sometimes it's rowdier than others. So, like, that book where all the kids died, for example, was a pretty rowdy one. The Choose Your Own Adventure was fairly rowdy, less rowdy though, I think, actually.
Yeah.
So this book about politics and
love,
existence, I guess.
I
guess we'll find out how the kids today respond to that.
Yeah, I don't know how it's gonna go. Gonna try and keep things light. Nora,
unbearably so.
Nora just said, this is my dad's favorite book and I hate it. So starting off on the good foot.
Tell us more.
So
no, you don't need to tell us more. We're here to provide the content. You just keep your butt in the seat.
Yeah. So what do you, have you ever heard of or read Milan Kundera, Andrew?
I have not. I know that he has the same name as your first name.
Yeah, but we pronounce it differently, which is weird. I don't know how that happened.
I don't know. Do the folks at home know that your first name is Mylan and not Craig?
I think it came up in a previous bonus episode,
Mylan,
actually.
Craig William Getting?
That's me. Yep. Because that's why some of our listeners call me Bill.
That is true. That is why everybody calls you Bill.
As we close out 2018, I'll allow Andrew to make one more impassioned plea for calling me Bill if he needs
Bill
to
his friends. I'm going to outlive you just so I can give your eulogy.
Here lies Bill. So I don't know why whenever my ancestors crossed the Atlantic and came to America, some of them started saying Milan instead of Milan or Milan or however. But it's my understanding that it's Milan Kundera. He is a Czech author, so shared lineage between me and him, I suppose.
Czech?
Checkmate. He was born in 1929. He's still alive, still going, Mr. Kundera is. And he was, I don't have too much on him. The big thing in his biography that I have, Andrew, is that he was exiled to France. He left Czechoslovakia in 1975 in exile. And has since, they took away his Czech citizenship. He naturalized as a French citizen in 1981, his stuff was banned in Czechoslovakia during, under the Iron Curtain for all of that time. And he grew up, he's in a generation of Central Europeans that they weren't adults before World War II. Like, they grew up during World War II and then went right into German occupation and then what it is to be a communist country.
Mm-hmm. And then they had to, reinvent democracy, basically.
Well, and then some of them tried to do that and then were invaded by the Soviets. And then after the wall fell, they had to, reinvent it again.
Getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, I think. But, more about the man himself, Milan. He is fairly secretive. He doesn't do a lot of media interviews. So I have a couple of interviews with him that I found, one in the Paris Review and one in the New York Times. But both of them refer to Unbearable Lightness of Being as a newish book. Oh. So that should give you some idea of how old they are.
Yes.
And he does occasionally go back to what is like the modern day Czech Republic / Slovakia. I'm not sure which of them he belongs to or would have belonged to, but when he does go back there, he does it without announcing himself. He's kind of incognito.
Sure. And,
yeah, but still lives in France to this day, as far as I know. His dad was a Ludwig Kundera, who was a musicologist of some renown, and Milan studied musicology and composition in school, and that music like shows up in his work in some unexpected ways.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if you can speak to, like,
I can,
if you
actually
noticed any of that in this, but yeah, let's like put that on your list as something to come back to.
Great.
Speaking to the New York Times interviewer, who
was this, the one with the Russian interviewer or person?
Yeah,
of Russian
Olga
descent?
Olga Carlisle is, yeah, the, I believe is the name of the interviewer. Got in touch with him and set up this interview, and then he says to her, "I must warn you of my bad disposition. I am incapable of speaking of myself and of my life and the states of my soul. I am discreet to an almost pathological degree, and there is nothing I can do against that. If this is possible for you, I'd like to speak of literature."
Is that, I think that's the same article where they quote Philip Roth, good old Philip Roth, talking about Kundera, who quotes Kundera saying, "When I was a little boy in short pants, I dreamed about a miraculous ointment that would make me invisible. Then I became an adult, began to write, and wanted to be successful. Now I'm successful and would like to have the ointment that would make me invisible." Which, ain't that the way?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, Tysafine says he sounds like a cheerful fellow. Gotta say, I agree. Sounds like a great guy. He would be great at a party, including the Communist Party, which he joined in 1948 when it came to power. But he was later expelled in 1950 for anti-party activities.
Yep.
He was pretty pro-communist early on, like especially in early poetry that he wrote. But by the time you get around to The Joke, which is one of his first big
novels, yeah,
novels from 67, this is in response to some political things that were going on at the time. It's all about, what is the quote I have? "Tightly written, elaborately constructed, The Joke was an indictment of the bleak absurdity of life under communism, but also of life anywhere when betrayal and revenge are allowed to corrode the soul." Mm. So what is happening in Czechoslovakia in the late 60s is this thing called the Prague Spring.
Yes.
This begins in January 1968 when a reformer named Alexander Dubček came to power. And it lasted around 8 months until August of that year when forces from the USSR and some other Eastern Bloc countries.
Yeah, Warsaw Pact nations. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically invaded. It wasn't a violent conflict. Like the Czech protests to it were primarily nonviolent, but it was basically Russia coming in and saying, well, this version of communism does not conform to our preferred version of it, and so would you maybe go back, please?
Yes,
to the version that we
Mr. Dubček had it wrong. Please stop. Please stop loosening your control of state media and state ownership of things.
Yeah, Dubček was trying to usher in some more like democratic reforms. Primarily, it was it's collectively sort of referred to as socialism with a human face.
Wonderful, delightful.
Yeah, great. I love my socialism to have a human face. And it was among other things, it briefly relaxed like censorship, including,
yes,
censorship of the press. And so you get for the first time Czech people engaging in this like interrogation of their history, you know, writing about things that had happened in their country without needing to say the right thing.
Yes.
For so the party would let you keep printing it. And yet the joke was part of, you know, a bunch of literature that sprang out of this movement.
Yeah.
Later on, like, so USSR, everybody else, they put down this Prague Spring thing. And for more than 20 years after, you know, things kind of stay the same. And then, you know, in 1993, by 1993, another thing called what, the Velvet Revolution,
I think
it's called.
I think that started in 89, yeah, and then the wall obviously fell and all that stuff.
Yeah, and that sweeps in and ends communist rule, and Dubček is part of that. But the most noteworthy thing that comes out of the Prague Spring as far as like geopolitical relations goes is Gorbachev, when he is reforming the USSR in the late 80s, early 90s, he is using a lot of Dubček's reforms as a template.
Interesting. Oh, I didn't know that. So, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's what was the cool quote that I found? When asked what the difference was between the Prague Spring and Gorbachev's own reforms, a foreign ministry spokesman replied, 19 years.
Sure. And after the Velvet Revolution, I think Vaclav Havel took over Czechoslovakia and then later the Czech Republic. And there's a couple like instances in the late 60s where Kundera and Havel are like going back and forth in, you know, the paper, like arguing about the country's relationship to communism and the country's relationship to Russia. And I think Kundera later took some of that back because Havel was proven right, or righter. as things went. So when this
go ahead.
Yeah. So when this book was published, it was 1984, he wrote it in 82, and then it was published in 84 in French first. L'insoutenable légitimité de l'être.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Beautiful. And then in...
What'd you get on your AP test for French again? Just
I got a
everybody?
Three. Enough three. To pass and never nice. Take French again, by God. and then in 1985, it was published in Czech for the first time, but it was actually published in by like a Toronto publisher because, you know, it wasn't going to come out in Czech. And then I think there was a Czech edition published again in 2006. I'm going to look up real quick who the translator is for this edition. Do you have anything else about the book that we should hit?
No, nothing that came up in my research. I have some interview quotes from Kundera that we can maybe talk about. Like here, so he, the joke is very political. Unbearable Lightness, I think, is a little political, but he kind of stops doing a lot of overtly political stuff after that. Like he wants to be known as a writer or a novelist and not like a political writer. But he has this to say about the sort of left versus right politics that defines the modern, like post-Soviet era. The danger that threatens us is the totalitarian empire. Khomeini, Mao, Stalin, are they left or right? Totalitarianism is neither left nor right, and within its empire, both will perish. I was never a believer, but after seeing Czech Catholics persecuted during the Stalinist terror, I felt the deepest solidarity with them. What separated us, the belief in God, was secondary to what united us. In Prague, they hanged the socialists and the priest. Thus, a fraternity of the hanged was born. This is why the stubborn struggle between left and right seems to me obsolete and quite provincial. I hate to participate in political life, although politics fascinates me as a show, a tragic, deathly show in the empire to the east, an intellectually sterile but amusing one in the west.
Yeah, I buy that. We're seeing populism versus democracy. Well, not populism versus democracy, but like autocratic populism versus
it's sort of
functional
like a
democracy.
A creeping kind of like power and surveillance and a lot of centralizing of like corporate power, I think, kind of that's happening so far, like regardless of who is in charge. And yeah, like it's just going to kind of sneak up on us in some ways.
Get ready.
And it doesn't care about left versus right. It doesn't care about any of that stuff. So yeah, everybody. There's our comedy book podcast.
We're going to come back to this idea of kitsch, I think, which crops up in Kundera's work.
Right. Taylor Kitsch.
Yes.
TV's Kitsch. Tim Riggins.
And what it is to go along with an agreeable movement or sign on to what the majority wants, and how that can be dangerous, you know, culturally and socially, regardless of what it means politically. The translation actually is by Michael Henry Heim. So that is, from what I understand, the canonical English translation. So I just want to give that a shout out. Let's get into the book, Andrew.
Get me into this book, please.
So I want to give you a quote.
Like the page master.
Yeah, I'm going to take you inside this book. A quote from, I believe, in the book. I pulled it from an article about it. It would be senseless for the author to try to convince the reader that his characters once actually lived. So that is the narrator at one point speaking to you, the reader, telling you that it is senseless for him to try to create like actual lives for his characters.
Mm-hmm.
So right off the bat, I just need you to know that like part of this book is about some characters who do stuff, and part of it is about like Kundera just wanting to talk to you about some stuff that's on his mind.
Okay.
You know, when we joked earlier about him being fun at parties, I honestly don't know if he would be fun at a party. So keep in mind, this book, the back of the book is telling me it's about a young woman in love with a man torn between his love for her and his incorrigible womanizing. Great start. Okay, cool.
Uh-huh. Same.
And, you know, it's going to be about feelings and things. And here's the first paragraph of the book. The idea of eternal return is a mysterious one, and Nietzsche has often perplexed other philosophers with it. To think that everything occurs as we once experienced it, and that the recurrence itself recurs ad infinitum? What does this mad myth signify? What? Excuse me?
What does it signify?
It signifies, he goes on to say, so he spends, what, two short chapters at the beginning of this book, and the chapters are actually all like two or three pages long. Rhythmically, I really like this book, actually. He goes into this idea of eternal recurrence, that like our lives happen over and over again, and therefore Nietzsche says we are kind of weighed down by our choices, because we have to relive them after we're done living. Like we have.
By the time you get to Nietzsche says in any sentence about anything, I think you're not fun at a party anymore.
Well, yeah. So, this idea that okay, your choices have more meaning because you're going to have to live them over and over. That confers weight on your choices, and Kundera's like, I guess so. I guess so, because Nietzsche's like, that gives them meaning. It makes you want to like deal with them and engage with them. And Kundera's like, yeah, but humans experience life linearly, not circularly.
Mm-hmm.
And so actually, your life is really light. Like you're probably only going to have the one. And what does that mean for all of your choices? It means that everything's ephemeral. It means that nothing has weight because it's gone at the moment you do it. No choice can have like more meaning than anything else because you don't get to go back and choose. You don't get to mulligan and choose your own adventure of your life, Andrew. You only get the one life. So doesn't that just mean that everything's just like out the window?
I guess. And if you're talking on a time scale, like a human civilization time scale.
Yeah.
And you're making choices. Like the effects of your collective choices as a big group of people probably will not become fully clear until you're not around anymore to experience the thing that you did.
Yes. And there's also a like, he then engages with this idea of whether or not lightness, he argues that this lightness is a fact, this idea that we only get to do the life once.
Uh-huh.
But is it a
very like a dour sort of YOLO?
It is.
Ethos.
So dour YOLO. That's my rap name. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? And then he brings up some Greek philosopher I've never heard of who says that lightness is a good thing as opposed to heaviness, which he doesn't really unpack much more than that. But the idea that, is it good for your life to have lightness? Is it good for you to realize that it's all ephemeral and then like not have any weight to your choices.
Why are we like, yeah. why are we being asked to make a value judgment on this thing that you're is not, just like,
you're not
true.
Asked, well,
cause you're asking me like, is it good? Like, does it matter if it's good, if it's just going to happen anyway?
Correct, I guess.
No, you can't.
So the book spends the rest of itself pondering the ramifications of this lightness and what it is for people who experience their lives with a little more weight to encounter people of lightness. Because the first two chapters are this kind of like philosophical essay stuff. And then chapter three, I have been thinking about Tomas for many years, but only in the light of these reflections did I see him clearly. And then all of a sudden the narrator in first person is telling us about a character in his book. What? Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense?
People just trying to self-promote any way they can, I guess.
But from there, we jump into Tomas, the womanizer, after we've been given a primer of like consequence and perhaps the lack thereof. Or does the fact that we only get to go around this starship Earth once lend things greater weight than the ephemeral nature of our life should?
Mm-hmm.
You can see why I'm not sure if he would be fun at parties, because he effortlessly dances between a story he's telling you about some people and like high concept philosophical stuff. I guess it's like hanging out with Chidi from The Good Place. A couple people in the chat are mentioning The Good Place, and I think that you might find Kundera as frustrating as Chidi at his worst. He doesn't know when to turn off the academia a little
mm-hmm.
bit.
Mm-hmm.
So Tomas, Andrew, I'm going to introduce you to our characters, because the book, they're kind of underdrawn on purpose, I think, because Kundera is more interested in the like philosophical ramifications of his characters.
Well,
than,
yeah,
like,
you've already introduced us to the main character, which is existential angst.
True. That's very true. So Tomas is this intellectual, successful surgeon man who is in his second marriage to a woman named Teresa. And Tomas just likes to have sex all the time, but not with his wife all the time.
Well, all right.
Because for Tomas, love and sex are not the same thing. And later in the book, he justifies his sexual escapades, like any good womanizer does, by saying he's like exploring the uniqueness of every individual woman, by saying that you can only really know someone in the nakedness of sex, which is its own statement to think about. But by getting in there and getting kinky with them, he is learning more about women as individuals, and he's just got to collect them all in a sense.
And so, in conclusion, this is why I think we should have an open marriage.
Yeah, basically. So I just want to read a little section that reminded me of one of my favorite episodes of Seinfeld.
Ooh, which one?
You'll see. Okay. Tomas came
the
to
whale
this.
One? Is Tomas it the whale golf the, ball one?
No, it's not. The sea was angry with this day, my friends. Tomas came to this conclusion. Making love with a woman and sleeping with a woman are two separate passions, not merely different, but opposite. Love does not make itself felt in the desire for copulation, a desire that extends to an infinite number of women, but in the desire for shared sleep, a desire limited to one woman. It's like when Jerry and Elaine are going to have sex again, and they have all the rules about not spending the night and not calling each other, and they're just going to be friends, but then they go in the bed sometimes.
This seems like kind of a stretch, but okay, fine, sure.
It's kind
that seems
of,
like kind of a stretch, both for that reference to call that to mind, and also for that to be your favorite Seinfeld episode.
It's not my favorite. Did I say it was my favorite?
You said it was one of your favorites.
I do like that episode. I don't know that it's my favorite. Sorry. Mm-hmm. It's just a weird thing to kick off your relationship with this character. And because this character is pretty much defined by this, and his relationship with his mistresses and his relationship with his wife, the book has been rightly dinged, I think, and Kundera's canon in general for how he portrays women, because they're all in these, they're all attached to these like awful men.
Well, because he's a male writing a book ever.
Yes. Well,
at any time in history,
because he's getting things wrong and he's not imbuing them with proper agency. And he's always kicking it off from this perspective of a dude who's justifying why he can cheat on his wife with like a philosophical exploration of the world. Kind of a mess there. So he is married to Teresa, who is a photographer who at one point in the book gets into some kind of dissident photojournalism, where during the invasion at the end of the Prague Spring, she is like photographing tanks and Russian soldiers and people coming into Prague, and like the women welcoming these soldiers and the protesters and things. And then later on in the book, you realize that the Soviets who've taken control have now used all of her photos to identify dissidents in a way that seems oddly reminiscent of 2018. There's a lot
like
of
on
that.
Reddit when they solve crimes
when they the Reddit detectives. Yeah, that's a bad thing. So the thing with Teresa that stinks from not Teresa's
aside
fault.
Aside from Tomas and his whole deal.
Stinks. Tomas's deal stinks for her because Teresa has all this baggage from her relationship with her mom, where her mom got like a really raw deal at the hands of a bunch of men, and unable to exact any sort of like revenge or justice on them, she ends up taking it all out on her daughter. And Teresa winds up with this like complex where she hates her body and would really just like to connect with Tomas on a spiritual level. And he's like, nah, like sex and love are different. I gotta go bang a bunch of ladies.
So if she gave this line to him, like, oh, I'm just gonna go bang my way across the Eastern Bloc because the only way to know the human experience is to bone everybody, I guess. Like, how would Tomas respond to that, do you think?
Not well, I don't think, because there's a part where they go to a party and she starts dancing with some dudes and he's like, whoa, this is what jealousy feels like. This sucks. You're like, this is all, I think, in like the first 40 pages of the book. It's like it's happening pretty quick, this whole setup of this awful relationship. And Tomas is this guy that you're like supposed to be intrigued by, because Kundera has set up this philosophical underpinning of the book of like, let's examine consequence, let's examine what a lack of consequence does to someone. Let's examine what it feels like to dislike living a life that way. One of the things that Tomas feels he gets hemmed in by is a stigma from his mistresses that he's married and cares about a woman, and a stigma from his wife that he has mistresses. Poor Tomas.
Poor Tomas. Caught between two, a rock and a hard place, this guy. Why do we always have to explore the human condition through like infidelity? Why can't we do it through like food or something?
Can you cheat on food?
No, you can't cheat on food, but like you can eat food like there are not going to be consequences. You can definitely eat food that makes you like have regrets and wish that you'd lived your life differently.
Okay.
I mean, I just spent like 5 days in the Midwest for Christmas, and I don't think I could get a piece of fruit that was not suspended in syrup or pudding of some sort. So I'm just, you know, why can't we, why always got to be sex all the time? Is
yeah,
my question.
That was actually my question for the first third of the book. I was enjoying Kundera's writing. I like his style.
Tosafine asks, what about cheat days, though? And so I think you do a book where every day is a cheat day.
Oh, dang.
And it sounds like, oh, this is great. But then you realize, I just want a salad so bad that I would kill somebody for it.
I would read a novelization of Super Size Me. Mm-hmm. Or did he just write a book? Did that guy write a book?
I don't know, man. I don't know anything about Super Size Me.
But a month of cheat days is just Super Size Me, I think.
I guess.
So why is it sex and why is it infidelity and like why is it picking apart the difference between sex and love? I was like worried the book was just gonna be that. So we also get introduced to Sabina, who is the
teenage witch. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Sabina, no R. Is the prime mistress of Tomas's life. And she is someone who very easily betrays people. She very easily leaves people. She takes a lover named Franz, who's our other main character. And later on in the book, after he leaves his wife for her, she's like, you know what? I'm gonna dip. You're kind of boring. And
she's not wrong.
No. And this is what Kundera says. Sabina, what had come over her? Nothing. She had left a man because she felt like leaving him. Had he persecuted her? Had he tried to take revenge on her? No. Her drama was a drama not of heaviness, but of lightness. What fell to her lot was not the burden, but the unbearable lightness of being. So Sabina is the lens through which we really explore, and Tomas to a certain extent, this idea that like by treating everything as ephemeral or experiencing it as such, we can feel that in and of itself can wear on us and be a condition that we don't necessarily enjoy and actually prevents us from finding happiness. So that's the like sex and love part of the book. The other part of the book is, yo, this is very much about the Prague Spring and what it is to have an identity that is separate or separated between different people, even versions of yourself. And I think the like sex cheating angle is really just a way to get into that. And yes, are there probably other ways to get into that? Sure. I don't know if there are food ways to do that. But the privacy angle of the relationship to the state and, you know, like an ever-watching surveillance state is part of this book, in a way that like he finds a way to make it resonate with the sex stuff.
Okay.
I think there are parts of it that are unsatisfying or at least you know, problematic is the easiest word to use, but I think there are probably deeper ways to talk about it. Where there's like a lazy male gaze at times. There is Teresa is in particular kind of a weak character and defined by a weakness that he doesn't counterbalance elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that all ties to the sex and power stuff. But the latter half of the book is a rumination in a lot of spots on how these characters interact with like being exiles or what they think about privacy and what they think about their country and their desire to be part of a bigger thing.
So you told me before we started recording that you wanted to talk about privacy.
Yeah.
And I feel like we keep making a bunch of parallels between the situation in the book and our present day situation, and it feels like privacy is probably a good way to do that.
Yeah, I think so.
What's the privacy angle? Tell me about it.
So there's the first one. There's this really interesting thing that the style of the book allows Kundera to do, which it's postmodern or at least modernist. I don't know where the difference is between those two. It's one of those two things where he stops telling you the story explicitly and instead gives you a series of chapters that are called A Short Dictionary of Misunderstood Words.
Dictionary just says the postmodern is subsequent to or coming later than that which is modern.
Gross. No. I love the Ouroboros Dictionary. It's my favorite.
That is kind of a postmodern definition. It's very self-referential.
Oh, dang. My James Joyce Dictionary strikes again. But so these chapters are illuminating the relationship between Sabina and Franz. And remember, Franz is kind of, he's the guy that Sabina takes as a lover. He is an intellectual kind of ivory tower dude who longs to connect to the real world, but...
So he goes to a diner in rural Pennsylvania.
Yes. He likes to participate in political marches to like feel a part of a thing, but he isn't actually a part of the thing. And he and Sabina have this moment where she puts on a bowler hat. She's like naked in their room and she puts on this bowler hat, and it's like it has meaning to her. It is her grandfather's. She also wore it one time when she had sex with Tomas, and it's yeah, it's weird. And like Franz doesn't get it, and he just thinks that she's kind of being childish, and then takes it off her and puts it back on the hook. And the follow-up chapter explains like what it means to her. And so Kundera does this whole riff on different words and concepts that they have extremely different ideas about, and how they can never really communicate these differences to each other. So privacy is one of them. In a section called Living in Truth, for Sabina, living in truth, lying neither to ourselves nor to others, was possible only away from the public. The moment someone keeps an eye on what we do, we involuntarily make allowances for that eye, and nothing we do is truthful. Franz, on the other hand, was certain that the division of life into private and public spheres is the source of all lies. A person is one thing in private and something quite different in public. For Franz, living in truth meant breaking down the barriers between the private and the public. He was fond on quoting André Breton on the desirability of living in a glass house in which everyone can look and there are no secrets. So that gives Kundera two different characters to explore what privacy is and what it means. And I don't know if either of those definitions resonate with you, Andrew, or like the importance of private versus public selves. Do you have, like, I know you don't want Jeff Bezos seeing what you do in your house.
I don't, but because I get up to a lot in here, you know.
Sure, that's true.
It's not all bad. It's just like I don't need him to see it. Wait, so is he talking about a glass house like being a desirable thing?
Franz is.
Yeah.
And Sabina is saying, nah, we kind of need to have secrets. That's kind of what defines us from other people. It creates the individuality.
Because the glass house thing is interesting, because it seems, you know, how sometimes people respond to stories about privacy breaches and spying and that kind of stuff with like, oh, I'm not doing anything wrong, so it's fine. Mm-hmm. Like, I think there's a version of that. There's an attitude toward privacy that says basically like, if we can all see what we're all doing, then, you know, we aren't going to do as many bad things. Or
sure, yeah, you see that a little bit in the, like, I don't know why I'm thinking about when John Ossoff ran for Congress, but there was like that hit ad.
Why are you
him.
Thinking about that?
No, okay, there was a hit ad on him where it was like videos of him playing beer pong or something, and I remember a bunch of takes that were like, this is gonna continue to be a thing, like, as people age, as they've grown up with social media, we're all going to have embarrassing photos of ourselves, and it's just going to be a thing that we all just like kind of tune out of.
Yeah, I think that's happening to some extent already, just because we're seeing the things that you can and cannot have in your past as you try to run for some kind of office.
Yes.
those are the parameters for that are changing, obviously.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that is directly relevant to the book, right? Like, I think Franz at some point is talking about how politicians view their actions through a public lens versus a private one. Tomas is a surgeon, and there's a really powerful vignette later in the book where he has written an essay about comparing communists who allowed the invasion to happen to Oedipus. And he's, or not, the, just before the invasion, actually. Communists who allowed, like, Prague to start to fall apart before the Prague Spring, comparing them to Oedipus and saying, if you knew it, like, even if you didn't know it was bad, aren't you guilty and shouldn't you, like, be punished? Or shouldn't you express some sort of guilt? And this is used as part of the justification for the Russian invasion, at least in the context of the novel. He's asked to recant, and he is, like, thinking through the ramifications of whether or not he even has to write the letter, because they'll probably just publish one with his name on it anyway. And what is the difference between this public version of himself that may or may not even be real and the private version of himself that he could, like, go to sleep with that night?
Mm-hmm.
And when you enter politics and when you enter kind of forces beyond your bedroom, even though the book is kind of arguing that they're in your bedroom also. When you take that into the political sphere, and certainly in the charged era of this part of Central European history, that whole public-private divide becomes very loaded. And I think Kundera doesn't want to take a side, even though I think he is on one. He poses a lot of things as questions, or he puts them in opposing characters' mouths through like this Sabina Franz thing, so that he doesn't have to answer it. He just has to, like, ask a question and then, like, force you to ponder that question for a while. I've been carrying around this book in the back of my brain without ever reading it because of an AP English test that I remember from, like, 2002, and I found the question.
They are useful.
They are. I found the question easily by Googling his name and AP test, and it is him talking about this book and talking about some Czech writers that were actually listened to by the police, and then the police started broadcasting the recordings on the radio, and it's this, you know. Is your private and public self, are they different? Should they be allowed to be different? What are you entitled to in the privacy of your own home as a person versus your public self? I think I wrote an essay about Bill Clinton in response to this for, like, a practice exam.
Hello, 2002.
I know. Nice, I don't know if I was again, like, channeling, you know, Rush Limbaugh or what I was, or Newt Gingrich or what I was doing in my essay. Who knows what I wrote?
My parents listened to a lot of Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah, the 90s were a weird time.
Like, I don't think they do anymore, but it was just kind of this ambient drone in the background of my house a lot of the time. And who even knows what I picked up?
Oh, I don't even know, man.
Who knows what kind of, like, Manchurian candidate nonsense that I have still in my head because I was exposed directly to Rush Limbaugh for all those years.
All of this to say that I wanted, are there parts of your self, Andrew, that you think you still keep pretty private from other parts of the world? And I don't need you to, like, spill them now on our podcast, but, like, you could also contrast them with public parts of yourself.
Yes.
Right? And so, like, what are some of those shared with, like, in important relationships that you have, does that line change?
It does. I'm not going to say that it disappears.
Right? Yeah.
It changes.
Yeah. I completely agree. And I think Kundera is taking that fundamental, like, human desire for a little bit of privacy and waxing philosophical about it for most of the book. The sex stuff is about, like, who is nude when, who is in control, you know, who is keeping what relationship from what person, who is keeping certain parts of themselves from each other. The political stuff is about what you can and can't keep from the state. What does it matter if you keep it from the state? And then there's a riff in the latter part of the book, Andrew, where he talks about whether or not God can poop. And
is this a version of the burrito conundrum?
No. No, it's
I feel
not.
Like if in God all things are possible, then
yeah.
I feel like God should be able to do number two.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think he did that whole day that he rested?
Oh my God.
The seventh one, I think, was the rest day.
Okay. I mean, could he make a burrito so big that... Think about it.
Could God make a burrito so good that even he didn't need to spend half an hour in the bathroom after?
So Kundera gets at this idea after unpacking this idea of kitsch, which he ties to, you know, as we talk about kitsch today as a like art, kind of crass mass market art. It's like kitschy stuff that you have in your house or like kitschy music. I don't know who would be I don't think Michael Bublé is kitschy, but he's close. Like, I'm trying to think
I can think of is like that Johnny Mathis Christmas album that my parents
had. Yeah, that's okay. That's pretty kitschy. Yeah. And Kundera is, you know, going back to the 19th century German origin of the word, and it's an appealing mask that you put on art, or things in general, concepts, ideas, so that you do not think about the more unseemly elements of them. So this comes to the idea of whether or not God can poop, because God created man in his own image, and if man can poop, then can God poop? But we don't want to think about whether or not God... I'm literally, summarizing pages of this book right now.
Okay, but, like... Speak for yourself, one, when you say, oh, we don't want to think about it, because I have been thinking about it nonstop since you brought it up. Number two, if you take God creating humans in his own image, like, super literally, things get bad pretty
fast.
Yes,
they do. Mm-hmm. They do.
I don't know. So say God knows that he's not perfect. Say God, basically thinks he's a fine, omniscient being, okay. But... that he's not perfect. And then he makes us in his image, right?
Uh-huh.
And then we do something bad, which maybe he does bad stuff too. Probably he does. And then he has the gall to get mad at us and like kick us out of paradise about it.
Uh-huh.
Is this philosophy?
It sort of is. Because in this whole rumination on God and how we cover up parts of it with an appealing message, aka kitsch, we like flatten it, and then he relates that to like what kicked us out of Eden or not, if that happened, right? He's like engaging with it as a theological idea and a philosophy, but he then connects it to that, similar to that quote that you brought up earlier, Andrew, about like it's not about left versus right, it's about totalitarianism versus democracy. He brings up this idea of kitsch as a political manifestation of our desire to be agreeable, and to go along with like an acceptable version of things, and not questioning things and not disagreeing with each other. So he then, in the latter part of the book, has Tomas join this political march in Cambodia. That is like a literal, it's a manifestation of something that he refers to as the Grand March, which is just the like, theory of ongoing progress towards a more just society. It's what the left is working for, right? And it's the whole like Pol Pot regime in Cambodia, the Khmer Rouge. And there's this like political march where they're going to march some doctors into Cambodia to like help people. And there's this, from Kundera's point of view, this idea of kitsch has like motivated all these disparate people to get into this March, even though they actually aren't there for the same reasons. There are like celebrities there who think that being celebrities means that they can get more exposure for this. There are people who are just there for the cause. There are people like Tomas there who just want to be part of something, and Kandera seems to think that's inherently misguided.
Also, he probably wants to meet hot singles in his area.
He probably does. He's probably on Tinder the whole time.
He doesn't have banner ads. How else is he going to meet sexy singles in his area?
And it doesn't go well. You know, it doesn't go well for anyone. And Kandera allows the march to kind of break apart and not succeed. I think as an argument against this idea of kitsch, this idea of smoothing over the disagreeable elements of a thing. Tomas also likes to refer to women not as an equal like part of the human race, but as a value. And Kandera says this directly. It's like, oh, I'm not just disagree. I don't want to offend Teresa. I don't want to offend the woman that is Teresa. And that's like, Kandera's like, what does that even mean, dude? You suck. You're latching on to ideas rather than people. And it's a thing he indicts his characters for that I think also the book is guilty of. You notice how I haven't talked a lot about like plot or things that happen.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it's a book about ideas, right? Which means that the plot is either non-existent or secondary.
It is secondary. It's not non-existent. There are scenes and images that I will definitely remember for a good long time because I do think the book is very successful in short bursts of like dramatizing this stuff. Like I said before, the scene of Tomas dealing with this essay that he wrote, where he thought it was like a clever idea of how to express what the communists in Czechoslovakia had given up and how they had failed, turns into this weapon of the totalitarian state against him, and a weapon of human nature against him. There is a long passage about Teresa caring for the dog that she and Tomas have that is very moving because her love for this dog is very pure. Andrew.
I was wondering if you paused because you had taken a look at the chat.
I had. Andrew's just in the chat just ragging on me. What a jerk.
Like, your body's fine.
It's Andrew. What a bro. These are the things I keep in the privacy of my own home. You're going to blast me publicly.
See, and so I've done this to draw attention to the book's themes of public and private.
I see, yes.
And just like, what does it mean? What does it mean when your mediumist, grayest mm-hmm. secrets are exposed to the world? And I just really hope I made y'all think a little bit.
Sure. Let me say two more things I liked about the book, because I feel like I've been ragging on it for a period of time, and it's actually a book that I'm gonna probably be thinking about for a while, even despite I think its shortcomings. One more thing about this idea of kitsch. There's a section where Sabina is now living in America, and she is talking to this senator. And she's like in a car with him, and they like stop at a playground to watch his kids play at the playground. And he's like, oh, isn't that wonderful? These kids, just, it's just the embodiment of happiness, isn't it? And this is what Kandera says. How did the senator know that children meant happiness? Could he see into their souls? What if the moment they were out of sight, three of them jumped the fourth and began beating him up? The senator had only one argument in his favor, his feeling. When the heart speaks, the mind finds it indecent to object. In the realm of kitsch, the dictatorship of the heart reigns supreme. I just like the little vignette he uses to show how powerful images and feelings are in like political speech. I don't think it's an accident that he makes this dude a senator. And the way that And he's talked in other interviews. He may have even said this in that Times interview you were citing earlier, Andrew, where he's talking about how, like, politicians are always going on about how we have to save the kids. Right. And, like, they never talk about doing anything for the elderly. They're like, our future, we must save our future. And the only future we are all assured is that we get old and need help.
I have a lot of thoughts about this. Yeah. I don't even know if we want to get into it. Like, for one, did you ever notice that most politicians are actually elderly? And that oftentimes they pursue short-term goals at the expense of long-term goals?
Yeah, they often do.
Yeah, so, like, what if we talked about that instead?
What do you mean? Oh, it's like politicians. You're not disagreeing with Kundera necessarily. You're disagreeing with politicians.
I'm just saying that he is not worried about the same stuff I'm worried about.
Oh, okay.
Like, if he is worried about politicians not adequately representing the interests of elderly folks, then I don't know. Like, there's a lot to be said about the way we treat older people and the way our social safety net is built to take care of them, but at the same time, it's not like we're in 2018, it's not like we are taking extraordinary steps to make sure that our kids can get old. And
no,
I don't know,
that's
like,
also
I guess I don't know how it felt at the time that he was writing this, but I feel like as I get older, and it feels like every year is maybe a little more depressing than the one before. Like, maybe being an adult is just like being kind of scared and uncertain of things all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I don't know. I don't know. Totally, I don't know what my point is, except that I don't know. This isn't the perspective I would come at this problem from, I guess.
Yeah. I also think that, to me, that speaks to what does work in the book. I think there was a great article by John Banville written in 2015 for The Guardian. One of our listeners, Gabby, shared it with me in advance of the episode. And it's revisiting this book, I think, because he published his last book was in 2014, and there were a bunch of hot takes about where Kundera stands and how relevant he is. And Banville says a lot of things that I felt about the book, that, like, the characters leave you kind of wishing for more because Kundera is interested in ideas. The treatment of women leaves a lot to be desired because they're objects first and foremost.
He's just trying to get to know all of them.
He is.
As true. You can only get to know them if you have sex with all of them.
Yes. And I don't think that could... on that specific instance, I'm not sure that it is a, like, depiction equals endorsement thing. But
right.
Because there is not a counterbalancing force, it just is bound to turn people off, and they are totally justified in bouncing off this book for that reason. But Banville says something to the effect of, like, it feels very relevant, but it doesn't feel perhaps as meaty as maybe Kundera thought it was, or that the initial reaction to the book thought it was, because it is dealing with this idea of lightness, ironically, or perhaps not ironically at all, and maybe even purposefully. The book is dealing with people at a very intellectual level and not kind of getting into their inner emotional life. And so you're not transported to another place in time. You're actually, like, during the course of the book, just thinking pretty hard and just, like, meant to reflect on some of your own feelings. And it does feel like I am at a party with a dude who has a lot on his mind, and I can't escape the conversation, so might as well engage with it. And it's not a boring conversation. I don't know that I agree with everything he's saying. But I found myself multiple times throughout the book going, huh, that's an interesting way of putting that. Huh, I hadn't thought about it like that.
I think you're describing the experience of recording a podcast with me.
Yeah.
It's a very small party that you can't leave.
But I do like a lot of his turns of phrase and his discussion of what the way that we as we close out, I do want to bring up that music thing that you mentioned earlier. That'll take us home. How about?
Okay.
He talks about the way that we make meaning in life. That has to do with this whole lightness idea, right? And it, he uses a musical metaphor and the idea of motifs and this idea that Tomas and Teresa thought that their love is this like wonderful, meaningful thing because of a series of coincidences of like shared points of interest in their first hour talking to each other. And they both look back and they're like, maybe those were just coincidences, but maybe those are also things that I feel are important about myself. And then from that point forward, those things become important parts of themselves because otherwise the love doesn't make sense. So Kundera is kind of, he rejects the idea that we should like knock books and stories for relying too much on like coincidence and these moments of like, oh, I can't believe it happened that way, because that's sort of what we do with our lives all the time anyway. Like, I don't know. I remember this essay question I cited earlier because this dude has the same first name as me, and it sounded like a thing I was vaguely interested in. And now I can't unthink of this guy's, like, I can't unthink this guy's thoughts. And I was always going to come back to this book for like a weird reason. Or songs and other stories that I've just kind of assimilated into my life and decided are meaningful because they meant something to me at a certain time.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any of those like songs that like, I'm thinking songs because that's because the music motif, but like that are like, now when I encounter that thing, it makes me feel something important or big.
I mean, the Vince Guaraldi Charlie Brown Christmas album has followed me through many, many phases of my life, and it reminds me of all of them in a lot of ways. It's not so much like a specific song or specific music thing, but I do like there are specific albums and bands, I guess, where when I do it, like I don't actively listen to them anymore, but when I do run into them, whether it's on a like Discover Weekly playlist or something else, it does take me back to that time in my life when I was listening to them. Remember in like 2009 or 2010, right after we graduated from college, where we were all just like sadly G-chatting each other about how the real world was kind of a bummer.
Uh-huh.
There's that album by Them Crooked Vultures, I think is the name. There's that super group with Dave Grohl and the Stone Temple Pilots guy and the Led Zeppelin guy, right?
Mm-hmm. The guy from, not Stone Temple Pilots, Queens of the Stone Age.
Oh, yeah. I knew it was Stone related. But I listened to that album a ton in like 2009, 2010, and then haven't listened to it since. But when I do run into a song from that album, it's like, oh, hey, it's 2010 again.
Yes. I know I have the exact same reaction to that album.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is, he does a good job of giving an analog to that, which is that like the weird bowler hat scene that I talked about before.
You mean the bowler hat
that she's wearing time? When she's naked. Uh-huh. Yeah, the sexy bowler hat. Because for her, the fact when she put it on when she was with Tomas in the first place, it was in her house because it was her grandfather's. It reminded her of her father. Then moving forward, it is a like a prop. It is a memory of like props from her time sleeping with Tomas and what that meant for her. It is also a sign to her that she is a person of like whimsy and originality. And it is a hymn. I think the book calls it like a hymn to a common past with people that she cares about or cared about. And then she butts up against Franz and it like doesn't click and she can't even like communicate that to him.
Mm-hmm.
So he uses this idea of motifs in our life, like leitmotifs from music, to say that like we have these melodies that recur, and every time they come back, they don't just have the meaning that they had the first time. They have the meaning that they've picked up since, or the meaning that they have at the moment that you re-encounter them. So then it's going to carry that forward the next time. And that's only possible because we don't experience life in eternal recurrence. It's only because, from Kadera's perspective, we experience it the one and done.
Okay.
And that's kind of, you know, stuff like that is like, okay, it's kind of weird that I'm getting this from a scene about a naked lady wearing a bowler hat, but like, props to you, dude, because it's pretty effective.
So, yeah, the unbearable leitmotifs of being, you might say.
Yeah, that's, I might say that. I might say that. I will make sure to tweet out a couple of the articles on Kandera, because I think they do a good job citing his critics while also pointing out where he, the context he was writing in, and doing a little bit more on the Prague Spring stuff, which I think is there's a lot to this book in what is otherwise a pretty slim 300 pages. It reads very easily, and maybe that's just because it's so conversational. But yeah, I'll make sure I get that out there. Oh yeah, yeah. You do look like you vape bitcoins. So if folks have read this book or have thoughts about whether or not God poops, you should send them to us at overduepod@gmail.com or hit us up on social media at twitter.com/overduepod or facebook.com/overduepod. This bonus episode was made possible by our wonderful Patreon supporters. Thank you folks in the chat for hanging out with us. And we hope you can join us for the next one. Andrew, if folks want to know more about the show, where should they go?
Should go to overduepodcast.com, which is our internet website where we have links to iTunes, Google Play, and our RSS feed. If you subscribe in iTunes/Apple Podcast, rate and review us, it makes us feel better. And if that's all it does, then that should be enough, I think. We also have links to our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/overduepod, and to a bunch of other stuff. Craig, we don't have a January schedule yet, but we will have one soon. It'll go up on the site and on Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah, it should be up by the time this bonus episode hits the main feed.
And so, another thing that is, I will say one thing that is on its way is we are reading book 3 of Twilight in January.
Yeah, buckle up.
Yeah, buckle up. I haven't started it yet, so.
It'll be fun.
It'll be great.
Thanks everybody in the chat for joining us. It's always a good time. We appreciate your support and we appreciate your fun goofs.
Yeah. Okay. Good night, everyone.
What do you say, Andrew?
Oh, wait. Try to be happy.
That was a HeadGum podcast.
You know, when we joked earlier about him being fun at parties, I honestly don't know if he would be fun at a party, because he might just want to talk about philosophy. Andrew, did you drop out of the call? Oh no. Uh-oh. Andrew's coming back. Don't worry, everyone. Oh boy. What do I do? I'm all alone. Someone help me. I'm here. Andrew. Oh no. Oh gosh, I'm here. Have you ever noticed what the food is like at airports? It's like food at malls, but more expensive. Have you ever noticed what food's like on airplanes? Nope, they don't give it to you anymore. It's just a bag of pretzels. That's not food. Have you ever noticed what food is like at baseball games? It's hot dogs. I don't know where Andrew is. You can only eat hot dogs at baseball games. I don't really know what to do because Andrew set up the call and this is going to get edited out. So I think that, oh God, Andrew's back.
I heard what you were doing as I was trying to get back into the... Just... I think you need a little work on your type five.
I do need to refine my type five.
I'm really sorry that I ruined the hangout by pressing Command Q when I meant to press Command W.
Okay, so as I was saying, oh boy.